From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
Welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings some of the most interesting, inspirational, and intelligent people on the planet directly to you so you can listen to a conversation that is sure to make a difference in your life. And that's really what we're trying to do, make a difference in the lives of people for time and for eternity. I've often talked about the three great apologetic issues, the first being the issue of origins. How one views their origins will inevitably determine how they live their life. If you feel as though you're a function of random chance, you're going to live your life by a different standard than if you know that you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. Now, obviously, in a Christian worldview, the God who spoke and the universe leapt into existence condescended to reveal Himself in time and space and demonstrated that He was in fact God through the immutable fact of His resurrection, something that we do not have to believe through blind faith, but rather can adhere to on the basis of faith founded on a refutable fact. And then within the Christian worldview, we also consider the Bible to be a reliable authority. And once again, we do not do that blindly. We do that because the Bible is demonstrably reliable. And so the issue of apologetics is of transcendent importance to the historic Christian faith. And I'm constantly looking for people who are able to articulate the great apologetic issues in a compelling fashion for our generation. We're not responsible for the last generation. We don't know what will happen in a future generation. But we are responsible for making a difference in this generation. And so I'm constantly looking for people who are interesting and inspirational and intelligent. And lo and behold, I found such a person in Northern Ireland. He wrote a book called New Atheism. His name is Graham Veal, and he is extraordinarily enthusiastic about introducing apologetics to young people. And I really care about that because young people live in an age of information overload and oftentimes cannot discern between wheat and chaff and heat and light. And so we need great apologists who can equip a younger generation to look through the potholes which are laid before them as traps in a new atheistic environment. And Graham Veal is just such a person. He holds graduate and postgraduate degrees in theology from Queen's University, Belfast. He's taught religious education for many, many years, almost two decades. And as I just mentioned, he is the author of a book that I came across. That's how I learned about him. It's titled New Atheism, A Survival Guide. And Graham Veal now joins me from Northern Ireland. He's in the midst of a major snowstorm. But I'm glad you have joined us for this podcast, Graham.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here. Hank, it's what we call a major snowstorm in Ireland. It's about 4 or 5 centimeters of snow, but we'll survive.
And it closes down the whole country, right?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. We just don't like anything that looks remotely like bad weather. We'll survive.
I mean, all I know about Northern Ireland is it's a great place to play golf.
Yeah, we have some very good golf courses, you know, fairly close together in Northern Ireland, so we produce some fairly good golfers over the year. I personally, I've tried it once, and it was a danger to everyone on the field, including myself. But there's supposed to be some very good golf around here.
I loved your book, and of course, I had you on the broadcast talking about New Atheism, and I think the title in and of itself is very intriguing. But before I get to that, your passion for equipping this generation of young people.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem that we live with now is the Twitter generation. I've been reading what people have called postmortems of New Atheism. So people think that the publishing phenomenon of New Atheism has gone on, but through Twitter, through different stand-up comedians like Ricky Gervais, I mean, a lot of these atheist memes, atheist, you know, arguments have been diluted down and dumbed down even further, if that was possible. And so young people live in a fairly hostile environment and can be continually bombarded with arguments and sneers and all sorts of things that would be pressuring them to give up on their faith. And the really sad thing here is that there really is, behind these arguments, there's not an awful lot of strength, there's not an awful lot of reasoning. And then on the other side of the equation is you have people who are unevangelized, people who really haven't been reached effectively with the gospel, and when they do encounter the gospel, have almost been pre-programmed, you know, by what's online to reject it as a fantastic fairy tale. So there's two sides of the coin here to try to, you know, encourage Christian young people in their faith and also trying to reach out to those outside the faith. So that's been something I've been passionate about and something that I've, you know, tried very hard to engage young people with.
You know, it's interesting, and you mentioned the word sneer. I mean, there's peer pressure, and young people feel a tremendous amount of peer pressure. But you also talk about what you just alluded to, the sense of sneer pressure, where the Christian faith is sneered at. It's looked at as though it is infantile. It is for those who've lost their brains somewhere in the narthex of a church. So people are belittled and in that way driven away from the Christian faith.
Yes, I mean, Dawkins and company were particularly good at this, at looking down their nose and, you know, young people are used to going into lecture theatres or schoolrooms and dealing with authority figures. And teachers quite often, I think because we encounter so much prima facie scepticism and cynicism from young people, we forget how much authority we have. And when authority figures sneer at an idea and won't even begin to engage with an idea because they just decide and pronounce that this is ridiculous, it can be very difficult to get a conversation started. To me, the best thing is to call it out for what it is. You know, this is a bluff. You know, before you sneer at me, you've got to earn the right to do that. You've got to present to me why it is that you think this worldview that I hold is so ridiculous. And that quite often is not done. Certainly, I mean, Ricky Gervais in particular would I worry about the effect that he would have on young people and people like him, just this continual sneering, this idea that if you've done any sort of reading, if you've cracked the spine of any book, then you couldn't take the Christian faith seriously. And I think another thing that we need to work out quite hard, you know, is the credulity of young people who will just, you know, quite often just give in very, very quickly, you know, to the first thing that they come across on Twitter, to the first thing and the first argument they come across on YouTube. And so, yeah, there's a strong sense of a rhetorical strategy that I would pick up, but a strong sense of a rhetorical strategy out there to try and demean Christianity before you can even get a conversation going. And I think that that's something that needs to be challenged quite strongly by the church.
There's so much information. We live in an age of information overload for certain, and people are not taught to think critically. And I don't really know what you would say in terms of solutions for teaching young people to think critically. How can that be done within the context of the current educational environment and the church?
In terms of the church, I think the most important thing is role models. And by the church, I don't just mean pastors, I mean parents as well. youth leaders, obviously, but I think quite often, I mean, a parent can have much more of an impact than a youth pastor. Now, that might be heretical in some circles to say that, and I'm not, I mean, youth pastors are very important, but the primary role here is that of a parent. And people with parental roles within the church, not just the person who's a paid professional, you know, youth pastor. So I think that those people who are spending time with young people need to model this in their own lives so that they are not just grabbing the first argument themselves that they see when they hit in Google. So if a young person comes to them with a question, why should I believe in God? You know, your approach if you're working with young people cannot be to Google why should I believe in God and go to the first argument which happens to suit your and throw that back to a Christian young person. You've got to go away and take thought and show them that you're taking thought and come back to them and say, well, I looked into your question and I looked at this and I looked at that and here's why I reached my conclusion or here's... And when people are modelling that sort of critical thinking in the home, and when pastors are prepared to do it in the pulpit, then young people can pick up on those habits. There's an awful lot that just cannot be taught from a blackboard or an interactive whiteboard. An awful lot of what young people need to learn needs to be actually shown to them and lived out in front of them. And I really think that that includes critical thinking. Now, obviously, that means somebody has to sit down. People have to sit and read books on this. And when people read books on this, they need to share it with those who, you know, this needs to be shared out and passed around the church. But if you really want to get this into a young person's life, the best way to do it isn't to hand them a book. It's to actually demonstrate it yourself continually. So that's how I see the church dealing with it. Education, again, I think it's a similar process where teachers have to show this in their classroom, have to continually model this and try to show young people that you just don't jump on the first, you know, the first article that you happen to come across, which suits your agenda or suits your point of view.
Talk for a moment about the implications of the new atheism. In other words, they're making incredible inroads into churches, actually. They're making incredible inroads, as we just talked about, in terms of the educational environment, but what kind of traction do they have at the end of the day? Are they winning the war? Are they ahead in the game, so to speak? Are they really advancing over what the old atheists do? I mean, you write about the new atheists, but how are the new atheists doing in comparison to the old atheists?
New atheism, I think, largely approached this debate with a sense of intellectual superiority. They assumed that the debate was over. They assumed that there was no debate to be had with Christianity or any religion, that they were right, that everybody else was wrong. They did this at a time, actually, when Christianity is probably stronger in the academy than it has been for a century, which might explain why they took that particular approach. And there was a strong commitment to scientism, to the idea that science had the answers to all these existential questions, which is to say there are no answers because science doesn't provide any. To the extent that New Atheism was a publishing phenomenon, I think that sense of New Atheism is probably over. You know, Jerry Coyne and a few others have tried to follow on from where Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, where those guys started. Others have tried to follow and haven't had quite the same success. But I think as a worldview, I think as an approach to this debate, I think it has actually seeped into the DNA of how people, and particularly young people, approach these debates, because it will come up much more likely now in, for example, Stephen Fry. There's a famous clip on him in The Problem of Evil, in which he simply restated the problem of evil and declared the argument over. You know, Ricky Gervais, if you watch him in late night shows, continually has a go at the existence of God, and he's using new atheist arguments, but without the book-length treatment. And I think this is actually a remarkable accomplishment. They've actually managed to dumb down new atheism. Now, that's incredible. It was a dumbed-down version of atheism to begin with. So my sense is that out there, these arguments that were started off by Richard Dawkins, which were popularized in these books, have seeped into the DNA of many people who are, you know, writing tweets, you know, who have their YouTube videos in particular. And this actually concerns me, the amount that our young people learn from YouTube and the amount that is absorbed through YouTube. YouTube can be a wonderful tool, but if somebody doesn't have a roadmap going in there, it can be a scary place. And the sort of propaganda you'll get there in a five-minute video clip on YouTube is it's been taken straight from these books, straight from this new atheist philosophy. So to some extent, that mindset has done very, very well, is still with us, and to some extent is much more difficult to challenge now that you don't have, you know, these guys out pushing their latest book on atheism. It's a bit more subtle, but it's alive and well, and it's something, again, that needs to be continually challenged.
It certainly does, and, you know, there is this idea within culture today that Christianity and science have always been at odds with one another, and I think this is one of the things that has to be dispelled in terms of mythology.
Oh yes, I mean, I've pointed this out in a number of debates, but one of the things that I would try and clarify is that the first scientists were Christian, or came from a Christian point of view, or Christian worldview. And that isn't just an accident. This is sometimes portrayed as, well, of course they were Christian, they lived, you know, back in the 1600s, you know, what choice did they have? As a matter of fact, that's neither here nor there. It misses the point completely. These guys were scientists because they were Christian, and it was their Christianity which had a direct impact on the birth of science itself. But you have to have a very finely tuned view of human reason to get science off the ground.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Graham Veal. Christians today are exposed to relentless attacks on theism by atheists. Graham Veal's book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, will help you understand atheism and how best to respond to the threat it poses. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. We'll return to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast right after this. Of Nancy Piercy's recent book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University says, liberal secularist ideology rests on a mistake, and Nancy Piercy puts her finger right on it. In embracing abortion, euthanasia, homosexual conduct and relationships, transgenderism and the like, liberal secularism is philosophically as well as theologically untenable. Piercy is precisely clear about what makes humans valuable. Don't just read, master Love Thy Body. To receive your hardcover copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. In The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, Duke University professor and New Atheist philosopher Alex Rosenberg bites the bullet and declares that to be a consistent atheist, you'll have to be comfortable with a certain amount of nihilism and, just in case, there's always Prozac. Because a growing multitude of college students are drinking deeply from this nihilistic nonsense, we shouldn't be surprised that so many of our national spiritual and cultural indicators are headed south. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, is an accessible, practical resource for responding to the nihilistic nonsense of New Atheist. To receive your copy of New Atheism, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's mind-changing and life-transforming outreaches, or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral,
furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Duke University philosopher Alex Rosenberg, a devout atheist, bites the bullet in noting that if atheists desire to enjoy life without illusions, they must realize there is no meaning or purpose of life, and there is no moral difference between right and wrong. Tragically, multitudes of college students are drinking deeply from this nihilistic nonsense. Graham Veal's book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, is an accessible, penetrating, and practical resource for responding to the nihilistic nonsense of atheists. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. Now let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Graham Veal in their conversation.
The first scientists were Christian, or came from a Christian point of view, or Christian worldview. And that isn't just an accident. This is sometimes portrayed as, well, of course they were Christian, they lived, back in the 1600s, what choice did they have? As a matter of fact, that is neither here nor there. Misses the point completely. These guys were scientists because they were Christian, and it was their Christianity which had a direct impact on the birth of science itself. But you have to have a very finely tuned view of human reason to get science off the ground. You have to believe that we live in a rationally ordered universe. You have to believe that we are smart enough to know what is going on in that universe to at least some extent. But we are not smart enough to work it out by sitting in our armchairs. We can make mistakes. We're flawed. So we have to go out and check our ideas by experimentation and observation. Now, that's actually a very finely tuned view of human reason there, which fits in very neatly with the idea of human beings made in the image of God, yet who were damaged in the fall. So human reason, while it is reliable, can be a flawed instrument which has to be checked. And also the mathematical view of the universe, the idea that mathematics can, the guy sitting in his house working on a mathematical formula can go out and use those mathematical formulas to explain and describe the world around him. That implies that there is a great mathematician who has this whole universe ordered and planned. But it's not just that belief in a divine architect. It's the belief that, yes, our minds can follow his mind, but we're fallen creatures, and therefore we need this experimental method. We need to do experiments. We need to check our ideas, because there is a God, but we're not him. There is a God, but we're not gods. We're fallen creatures. And if we look at some of the work in the history of science, it's this idea of a fall, and we're fallen, and we need to check authorities. We can't just accept what our ancestors said or what's in tradition. We have to come back and we have to check and look over it again with experiment. It becomes extremely, you can't get science off the ground without these things. So the idea that Christianity and science are somehow at loggerheads and that one is always doomed to destroy the other, I mean, that's absolute nonsense. You'll struggle to find any textbook in the history of science that would seriously make that argument. You'll find it in popular literature. You'll find it on the internet. But, I mean, you're not going to find serious historians saying this. I mean, take one final example. Usually people will go back and attack Christianity, and they'll go back and say, look, you know, the fossil record, and they'll get into debates about the origins of the species and all sorts of things about the origins of the earth. And my big question is, why is it that we are interested in the history of our planet? If you look at Plato, if you look at Aristotle, if you look at the ancient Greeks, they weren't remotely interested in the history of the planet Earth because they assumed that it had been around forever and would be around forever. But it was only when you get Christians who believe that history is important, history has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and has a meaning, that's when you actually get guys going back and starting to look at the age of the Earth and begin to look at the, I say, what, you know, what is this history? What does this teach us about our Creator? So this idea that Christianity and science are at loggerheads, it's horrifying to me that so many people have bought into this. And it's horrifying to me the number of Christians who will buy into this and will almost either have a fear of science or will, you know, be somehow reticent to enter into these debates in any way. Science, to me, the success of science is one of the, it's a vindicating factor. It's a vindicating evidence for Christianity, because this is something that only started in a Christian culture and could not have started with the Greek free of reason, and the Romans didn't even attempt anything like this. You need a very, very, very specific set of beliefs before you can get science off the ground, and Christianity provides that ground, provides that fertility, provides that, you know, provides the nutrients that science needs to get up and running.
Yeah, I think that point has to be emphasized, Graham. The fact that science could only have arisen within the context of a Christian worldview. Mm-hmm. It certainly could not have arisen within the worldview of the Greeks, who believed that the universe was ministered by moody gods. It took a Christian worldview to give rise mm-hmm. to science, and therefore to think that science and scripture, or science and Christianity, are at loggerheads, as you put it, is irrational to begin with, and it belies a misunderstanding of history.
It really does. I mean, it isn't even polytheism. If you can even take Plato's theism or his view of the universe, where, you know, there is a rational structure to it, but he believed that you could sit, you know, in your armchair and work out all you needed to know. It actually takes something like Christianity to come along and say, no, you might be smart, but you're not God. And God, by the way, is free to make the universe any way he likes. So you can't sit in your armchair and work out that, you know, God would have made the world in such and such a way, with the earth at the center and everything in a perfect circle around it. You've got to go look, observe, measure, because there is a God and you're not him. And today, actually, I also think that Christianity provides a better grounds for science than atheism. Because at the end of the day, if you believe that the human brain came about through natural selection alone, and there was no overall guiding intelligence, then you believe that the human brain was basically designed to get you away from danger, to get you to food, to get you to a mate. But it was not designed to work out how the planets go around the sun. It was not designed to teach you about subatomic particles. It was not designed to answer any of these questions. And when you look at the history of science, most scientific theories in the past have failed. So it would be very easy for somebody to draw the conclusion, well, you know, maybe most of our current theories will fail. Maybe science doesn't take us to the truth, because after all, we've got these great big cognitive engines in between our ears, but they weren't designed by anybody. They've just been cobbled together over the eons. And they're really not designed to teach us the truth about the universe. They're just designed to propagate our species, to keep us, you know, to keep our selfish genes moving along. So if you believe in a designer, if you believe in a creator God, if you believe that God made you to understand this world which he created, then you've got motivation and an intellectual justification to pursue science. If you believe that the atoms just shuffled around and out we popped, now, okay, I mean, it's more complicated than that in evolution by natural selection. But when it comes to issues like understanding the universe, subatomic particles, quantum physics, general relativity, all these very subtle grandiose views of the universe. Our brains weren't designed for that sort of thing at all. They were designed to get us away from saber-toothed tigers and to get us to meet and to find a mate. And that's what our brains were inverted commas, designed to do, if you put that in quote marks. And so to me, the Christian historically had a, only Christianity could have given birth to science, but I think only Christianity can really give you any intellectual justification to continue to pursue it. There seems to be a great big blind spot in contemporary atheism, in that they have this tremendous faith in the scientific worldview, but they seem to cut off the branch that they're sitting on. They seem to be saying this scientific worldview is wonderful and it tells us about everything, and it tells us that our brains and all our cognitive equipment was put together. Well, it wasn't overseen. It just sort of came together as the best job nature could do over the millennia, over the eons. So it really, I think Christians need to really, really, really make atheists think much harder about science. And whenever they raise the issue of science, we need to be saying, look, I'm glad you raised the issue of science. Do you understand how important Christianity is for the history of science? Do you understand how important Christianity is for even justifying the pursuit of science today? Those are questions Christians need to grasp with both hands. And there are plenty of resources online and on bookshelves and in bookstores for pastors, youth leaders, parents, everyone to be grabbing and getting into.
But how do you get pastors and parents and youth leaders, how do you get Christians in this epoch of time interested in the intellectual arguments? I mean, it seems to me that in so many churches we are entertaining our kids to death as opposed to educating them. I remember, father of 12 children. We grew up in Southern California. And my kids used to complain about some of the churches that they were in. They said, if we wanted to go rock climbing or if we wanted to be entertained to death, we'd go to Disney World or Knott's Berry Farm. We want to learn something, and the churches simply were not educating children. They were babysitting children.
Oh, I'm really, really, really glad you said that, because I could not agree more. I worry about evangelicalism as an evangelical, but I worry about the future of it. And a friend who I discussed a lot when I was writing my book, Peter Maher, a great fella and a teacher as well, and as we've been talking to young people, and as I listen to a lot of young people talking to me, as my job's teaching teenagers, there are a lot of teenagers out there who by the time they are hitting their late teens are incredibly frustrated that the church is not providing answers to questions that they have. They are aware that the answers are there. I'm not talking about a drove of young people who are prepared to lose their faith. I'm just talking about young people who are despondent and frustrated in that they want to understand their faith more deeply. They want to understand how to reach out to others outside. They want to be able to bring their friends to church and have their friends' questions answered. And churches really are more interested in what you've described as babysitting. I think this is to do with parents afraid of losing their youngsters, parents afraid that their youngsters will drift away from church. And a young person sitting at the back of the church, if my teenager sitting beside me in church, there's something visible that I can see, and that can convince me that, you know, their heart's really in the faith. But unfortunately, the only way that you can know a young person has really committed their life to Christ is the life that they will lead when your eye isn't on them. And it might be frightening, but really, we have to start teaching Christianity as if we mean it, as if the answers which we are providing are important, that it is important that young people understand them. And we need to do that passionately, and we need to do that persuasively. Because if we are not doing that, they will leave us eventually anyway, and they will be leaving us with less of a chance of return.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Graham Veal in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth, and receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after this quick break with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Richard Dawkins' grasp of philosophical arguments wouldn't earn him a passing grade in a freshman philosophy course, but he doesn't mean to deal with the questions that theists are asking. He simply ridicules his opponent's position. In New Atheism, A Survival Guide, Graham Veal explains, "The new atheist stance is that the reasons for theism must be so bad, why even read about them? My goodness, no, you'd just dismiss them." Veal goes on to show that the new atheists have not offered one original argument for atheism, but they've plenty of original insults. New Atheism offers an accessible, practical resource for countering new atheist attacks. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thank you gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Of Nancy Piercy's recent book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University says, "Liberal secularist ideology rests on a mistake," and Nancy Piercy puts her finger right on it. In embracing abortion, euthanasia, homosexual conduct and relationships, transgenderism and the like, liberal secularism is philosophically as well as theologically untenable. Piercy is precisely clear about what makes humans valuable. Don't just read, master, love thy body. To receive your hardcover copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Richard Dawkins' grasp of philosophical argumentation wouldn't earn him a passing grade in an undergraduate philosophy course. Yet the dumbed-down ridicule he and other atheists wield slides effortlessly past a growing number of college students receptive to such ridiculous rhetoric. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, offers an accessible, penetrating, and practical resource for countering atheist attacks. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Now let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Christian apologist Graham Veal.
You know, speaking as a human being, if a young person leaves your church in their early 20s and they've just been entertained, the odds of them coming back to you are very, very small. Now, I know God has a plan that we can't see into, and he can create all sorts of circumstances that we can't predict. But from the point of view of human wisdom, it is insane to entertain your child up until the age of 19. Because if their heart wasn't in the faith to begin with and they drift away, how are you ever going to pull them back? We need to really, really talk as if the Word of God means something, that there was a reason for God to call his Son the Word. And to begin the Gospel of John with it was, in the beginning was the Word. Words matter. Truth matters. These things are at the heart of the faith, and we have got to start taking this much more seriously. Christianity is not a lifestyle and cannot be sold as a lifestyle. We have got to get it through to young people. We've got to get it through to parents that this matters because it's true and because it's real. And the challenge of the Christian life and the excitement of the Christian life, to be honest, is found in day-to-day life, living out those answers and living out the Word of God and trying to live that in your life day-to-day. It is not found in the few small hours that we spend in church. And if we try to generate excitement there, we miss the actual excitement of the Christian life is when you leave prepared and you go out and you lead it. That's where the challenge comes. That's where the battle begins. That is where you really feel your faith and where your faith is tested. We seem to be living in a culture that just does not want that to happen to our young people. We want to get our young people into churches. We want to get them away from intellectual challenges. We want to get them away from, you know, meeting anything that we don't control, because in case we might lose them. And my worry is that we're really not getting the faith out there, that there are lots of Christian young people who really don't understand what I would have called the basics of the gospel when I was a young person. And what probably could have been described as fundamentalist Protestantism, I would have said I would have a much better understanding of the Christian faith than what a lot of evangelical Christians, young people, have now. It's really quite worrying.
I think something else that needs to be addressed is that while truth matters, we could argue that life matters more. And what I mean by that is the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. And so we have to, on the one hand, arm our youth with good apologetic arguments. But on the other hand, we have to let them know that this is about an experience that they can have with a living Christ that is far more vibrant, far more enriching, far more significant than anything that the world has to offer, that we ultimately fill a God-shaped vacuum with God and with life in the Trinity, being partakers, as Peter put it, of the divine nature.
Yes, yes. It's funny, as I was just reading through the Bible, I came across that text the other day, and it hits you like a bolt from the blue. Other Christian traditions might be much more switched into this than the evangelical tradition is, but that text, it just comes to me. We've been reading through, you know, Paul, all of a sudden you get Peter saying this to you. It wakes you up, and there is a tremendous excitement in that. I mean, it is extraordinary, the love of God, and it's extraordinary the God that put this universe together. His Son, the God the Son, becomes incarnate, comes down to meet with us, and the humility and the love there, and then the fact that you can know him and be brought into that loving relationship that the Father has with the Son, that the Spirit can bring us into. Getting into that life and reflecting on that, and like you said, experiencing that, can be tremendously exciting and can be tremendously empowering and can lift people up in the most difficult of circumstances. If I talked about the importance of modeling and the importance of Christian young people having role models, one of the issues that we have with young people are obviously intellectual objections to the faith, but the other issue that we have is cynicism and the idea that somehow there is no real goodness in this universe. There's only selfishness. And and worldviews that will let you down in the end. You know, no matter what you buy into, it's going to let you down in the end. It's going to fall apart. There's a tremendous cynicism that comes across in the Hollywood culture, that comes across in the films it produces. If you can introduce a Christian young person to an older Christian who's facing tremendous difficulties, who's facing illness, who's facing all sorts of horrible situations, and their faith keeps them buoyant, their faith strengthens them, their faith is real and living, then that is something real and tangible that a Christian young person can see and get to know and can understand, that this is not just a set of pat answers that are handed down by an apologist or a teacher or a pastor, that this is real and this is living and it does not let you down. And again, the key there is not having a lot of events in your church. The key there is that the young person actually really genuinely knows people in the church, and that there are people in the church whose faith is mature, and that the young people can look at and look up to and aspire to be like, because that person has maybe had a life and faith with Christ that they haven't had, and that's something that they want to pursue. And so the simple importance there of Christian fellowship, but you have to genuinely know the person. This cannot be Christian fellowship in the sense of we all had a nice day out or we all had a wonderfully exciting youth event. Those things can be fine in their place. But, you know, we need to get past the style and get to the substance and ask, what are we really looking for here? And I can think of older Christians that through their lives spoke to me, not necessarily through anything that they even said. I can't remember what they said. I can think back to my own grandfather. And it's not so much what he said, but how he lived and the impact that that would have on me. So, yes, we do need to get life out there. We need to show the importance of the Christian life and enthuse Christian young people to get to know Christians, to get to know older Christians who have lived this out, and kind of explain to them and show them through their lives just how important it is to know Christ, just for, like you said, to know that this is real and sustaining and powerful. Those things are very important.
What's your story, Graham? What context did you grow up in? How did you get to the point of teaching, particularly teaching issues with respect to apologetics and writing a book like New Atheism?
I grew up in a Brethren church in East Belfast, in a working class area, and my father and my grandfather would have been Brethren. So it would be fair to call it fundamentalist. And in fact, when I asked my dad about fundamentalist, I remember when I was going into Bible college, I did my degree in theology, and coming across for the first time the degree between evangelicalism and fundamentalism, and going home in great pride saying to my dad, you know, I'm an evangelical, I'm not a fundamentalist. And he was quite happy to be called a fundamentalist. He had no difficulty with that at all. Because to him, it was back to the original, you know, the books, the fundamentalists. He was quite aware of that. So that would have been my background. But there was a strand of anti-intellectualism there. There's one pastor in Belfast who was famous for telling people they could take their degrees to hell with them. And an idea that somehow, if you maybe don't want your young people getting a university degree because they'll lose their faith. So I probably had a lot of intellectual doubts when I was a teenager, which didn't help me. I was quite an anxious teenager. That got me interested in reading apologetics. George McDowell, I think, was probably one of the first books I lifted down and read, and was absolutely astonished to find that there were answers to these questions. And in a way, brought the faith to life to me in ways that I found quite surprising. Because once you start reading about the history of Palestine, and you start saying, you know, an argument for the truth of the Bible is that Jesus fits that historical context, all of a sudden, you know, you're putting this into flesh and blood history in your head, and it comes to life in ways that I found really mind-opening and very inspiring. So from that stage, you know, I couldn't get enough of this sort of book. when I went to university, a guy I met there was David Glass. He's written a book, Atheism's New Clothes. And David and I, he now lectures at the University of Ulster in computing and maths, but his PhD's in physics. He's postgraduate degrees in philosophy. And he and I have really had a friendship really going back over 20 years. We've both been very passionate in trying to get these ideas out there and to try and get the church to see the importance dealing with these issues of reasoning with unbelief. And it can be difficult in Northern Ireland. You know, it can be difficult, and it can be a long, slow battle at times because there's still that wee bit of suspicion of anything that seems too academic in many churches. We believe it's an important work, and we keep plowing on as best as we possibly can, and continuing to write and to continue to try and do talks and get out to churches. If you get near the universities, people would be more open to you. But that would be roughly my background, coming from a fundamentalist and a more sort of evangelical Baptist view of things. But really, I do feel within evangelicalism as a whole, and talking to people in different denominations and and really having a look at what's going on over the Atlantic, there does seem to be a little bit of I don't know if you can have a small crisis, but I think there is a small worry that there's a crisis brewing here, in that we're not doing a great job of communicating, you know, the truth of Christianity. And the case for Christianity, but first and foremost, the actual truths that we need to defend to young people. So that would be roughly the background.
Yeah, and sometimes I think too, Graham, we've made the Christian faith transactional as opposed to transformational. The idea that you get a quick profession, and after you've made the profession, you get a car that gets you out of hell and gets you into heaven. And now you live as a baptized secular humanist. And this gets back to what you were saying earlier. I mean, if you look at Christians and what they're modeling, are they really modeling a transformational lifestyle? Or is this just a transaction that gets me into heaven and I can live just like the culture lives? And when the kids see that, they think, look, there's no difference between the culture. It's maybe a little bit more prudish and backwards, but there's no real big difference between the way my parents, my school teachers, my pastor, my youth pastor, there's no real big difference between them and the world after the transaction is all said and done.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Christian apologist Graham Veal in its entirety, go to equip.org. iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receive as our thanks for your gift, the book New Atheism, A Survival Guide, just call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI, Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. In The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, Duke University professor and New Atheist philosopher Alex Rosenberg bites the bullet and declares that to be a consistent atheist, you'll have to be comfortable with a certain amount of nihilism and, just in case, there's always Prozac. Because a growing multitude of college students are drinking deeply from this nihilistic nonsense, we shouldn't be surprised that so many of our national spiritual and cultural indicators are headed south. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, is an accessible, practical resource for responding to the nihilistic nonsense of New Atheist. To receive your copy of New Atheism, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's mind-changing and life-transforming outreaches, or visit equip.org.